Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Sam Dingman. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we take a closer look at undocumented immigrants in the country and why it's a population that's going up.
And we'll meet a very specialized consultant in naming babies.
But first, it is primary election day in Arizona, and voters are heading to the polls to decide who will represent each party in an array of important elections from the federal to the state and local level. Voting sites are open across the state from 6 a.m. until 7 o'clock tonight. Voters can also drop off their early ballots at those sites as well. In Maricopa County, there are 223 vote centers open today, and registered voters can cast a ballot at any of them. So far, things seem to be going pretty smoothly at the polls, but that's not always been the case in Maricopa County. We're joined now by Maricopa County Supervisor Bill Gates, who is at the Maricopa County Tabulation and Election Center this morning. Good morning, Supervisor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So tell us first just what things are like there this morning. Things seem to be running smoothly, a little different than last time around in 2022.
Yeah, things are moving smoothly. Like you said, we have over 220 vote centers that are open across Maricopa County, and we've already had thousands of people who've checked in to vote. So we're off to a great start.
Thousands of people. Any lines yet? Is it busy? A little too busy?
No, not at this point. People have been able to get in and out pretty quickly. And so we always encourage people, if you can get there early, you know, get that, check that off your to-do list for the day and go on with the rest of your day. So we're just so grateful for all the thousands of employees and temporary workers who help us to run these elections in Maricopa County.
Yeah. So last time around in 2022, we were seeing issues with about 20% of ballot tabulator machines across Maricopa County. Talk about the preparation that county officials have gone through to be ready for today. The stakes are really high. Like, all eyes are definitely on elections here because of issues in the past, as well as the rise of election misinformation.
Yeah, it is. We do understand that the eyes of the country, if not the world, are on us on Maricopa County elections. And as far as it relates to some of the issues that we had at some vote centers with the tabulators back in 2022, the issue was really related to the printers. And some of the printers were printing too light, too faint to be picked up by the tabulators. That's why my colleagues and I on the Board of Supervisors have committed $9 million to purchasing new printers so that we don't have a repeat of that issue. And like I said, things are going smoothly this morning.
Yeah. One thing I've heard a lot from election officials heading into this election is that there's no such thing as a perfect election, right? There's no such thing as no problems. What if things go wrong today? Like, how will you handle it? Are there contingency plans?
So you are absolutely right. There is no such thing as a perfect election, particularly in a county of our size, you know, the fourth largest county in the country. But we are ready for various contingencies, whether it has to do with the power going out, whether it has to do with issues with any of our machines, or if there are any weather-related issues, too, that could have an impact. We're ready for whatever is going to come. And here's the other thing, too, is that we have put a premium on communicating. So if people have any concerns, any questions at all, we encourage them to go to Maricopa.vote. That is the trusted source for information on whether it is where the vote centers are located, or if people have any questions about what identification they need to bring if they want to vote at the polls today.
Mm-hmm. This is the first primary election, I think, where vote centers are required to hand count the number of mail-in ballots that are going to be dropped off at each voting location today. We mentioned folks can do that today on election day. How might that affect things?
So you're right. This is the first time that we have been required to do that. And so for your listeners, what the state legislature passed a law, the governor signed it, which says that all of, so we're not talking about the people who vote in person on election day, but instead the people who drop off their mail-in ballots on election day. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know, after 7 o'clock, when everyone has voted in person, we then have to count up the number of green envelopes that were dropped off at that vote center. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we're going to comply with the law and do that. The reality, and people need to understand that, that's an additional job that's now been given to our workers out there. So it could we have to complete that process of counting all those green envelopes before the memory cards, which have the votes that have been cast at mm-hmm. that vote center. We have to wait until we're done counting up all those envelopes before bipartisan teams can bring those memory cards into our central tabulation center, where those memory cards are then put into the server, which is not, you know, connected to the internet. So bottom line is, it might slow down the results after the initial 8 p.m. results, maybe just a little bit.
Right. So talk about the timeline here in terms of when we can expect results to start coming. Polls close at 7. You said 8 p.m. first results will roll out. How long might it take to get everything counted?
Yeah, so we will have at the 8 p.m., right around 8 p.m., we will be reporting the lion's share of the early votes mm-hmm. that have been coming in since July 3rd. So that'll be a big number that will be reported. Then from that point throughout the evening at various times, we will be reporting the results from, we'll be adding the votes in that have been cast today. So that'll be going on into the night, into the wee hours of the morning. But we will continue to update those totals until we have tabulated all the votes that are being cast today. Then over the next few days, we will add additional, around 5 p.m. or something like that each day. We will be reporting the additional results that will be coming in. Our anticipation is that we'll have about 95% of the total votes will be reported by this Friday.
By Friday. All right. Lots to watch for there. Maricopa County Supervisor Bill Gates joining us from the Maricopa County Tabulation and Election Center. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now let's head to the polls, where our own Cameron Sanchez has been talking to voters this morning. She is at the Mesa Convention Center and joins us now to talk more about what she's seeing this primary election morning. Good morning, Cameron. You've been out early, right?
Yes, I have. Polls opened at 6 and I was there at 6:13, so almost perfect.
So tell us what you're seeing so far at polls this morning. Are you seeing a lot of people?
I am now. When I first got there, I was at a voting center in Scottsdale, and there was pretty much nobody. But after about an hour or so, people started to trickle in. And now here in Mesa, it's getting pretty crowded as the day heats up.
Yeah, as the day heats up, you're outside, I'm sure. There are some rules about where you can be, who you can talk to, right?
There are. I mean, the most enforced rule is the 75-foot limit. You're supposed to not do any electioneering, et cetera, photographing people inside that limit. So everyone's outside in this sort of arced perimeter.
All right. Well, thank you for being outside for us on this morning that's, I'm sure, getting hot already. Tell us about the district you're in there in Mesa. What's on the ballot there?
Well, there's a lot going on in this district. There's a mayoral race. There's some city council seats up. And then in the legislative district, this is considered a very, very competitive area. So it's purple. There's a chance that Republicans could win, a chance that Democrats could win. And of course, the congressional district is 4, so it's represented by Stanton. And then everyone can vote for U.S. Senate. And I've seen some signs for U.S. Senate races.
Some signs for Senates there, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Have you gotten a chance to talk to any voters? What are you hearing from them?
I have. Everyone seems excited. They say that things have gone smoothly. No one said there have been any issues so far. I talked to one guy who is a Republican, says that, you know, he's excited to vote. He says he's not super thrilled completely with the Republican Party, but he doesn't want to be an independent and have to pick a primary ballot every time.
Let's hear from him now.
Normally, I always vote in person. I like to come in, do it here, make sure it's there and taken care of. It's just an opportunity. I've got my grandkids all excited about voting as soon as they turn 18. So that's all happening. Two of them are already over the age and they're happy to vote. And I got a couple more that are under 18 and they can't wait to start voting. So win or lose, at least get out and express your opinion.
And that is Mesa voter Jerry Earls. Cameron, talk about voting operations, what you're hearing across the county and the state. We just heard from Supervisor Bill Gates in Maricopa County at the tabulation center there. Are we getting any reports of issues anywhere else in the state? Any concerns from voters?
No, so far so good. I mean, I've heard some voters say that they are concerned generally with election integrity, but they didn't point to anything being wrong today here in Maricopa County. I actually talked to a couple just before I got on the call who said that their fears concerning election integrity have been satisfied. They say that they're now satisfied that everything is safe and secure. And yeah, mostly just a lot of excitement. People are happy to have the opportunity to vote.
Yeah, there's an interesting collection of voters who come out on, you know, to the polls on election day, as opposed to the vast majority who send them in early ballots, right?
It's funny that Gates mentioned those green envelopes, because I would say a huge chunk of these people are carrying the green envelopes. So they actually filled out their ballots before they got here, and they're just here in person on election day to drop them off rather than check in and vote. Yeah. The normal way.
Yeah. Okay, so final minute here, Cameron. We're expecting the first results, as Bill Gates told us, about an hour after polls close this evening. What are the biggest races you're watching for? What are the results you want to see as soon as they come in?
Well, we're trying to keep an eye on as many of them as possible, but obviously the U.S. congressional races and the U.S. Senate races, those are the biggies, and then some very competitive legislative races. And this year, the politics team is also keeping an eye on some of those Maricopa County races, including county sheriff, county attorney, and county recorder.
Yeah.
So, yeah, tune in for that tonight.
Tune in for that tonight. All right. Lots to watch for as well in the coming days. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk joining us from one of the polling sites in Mesa this morning. Cameron, thank you for getting up early for us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a baby name consultant explains how she helps parents make an important but difficult decision.
But first, as we barrel toward Election Day 2024, immigration will certainly remain a top issue here in Arizona and across the country. Republicans have vilified what they call an invasion of illegal immigrants and accused them of causing a rise in crime, a claim that has been disproven by data. So this morning, let's take a few minutes to find out more about what we do know about undocumented immigrants living in the country. The Pew Research Center is out now with a report on this population, and they found it's growing. I spoke more about it with Pew's Director of Race and Ethnicity Research, Mark Hugo Lopez.
Yes, this is a population that's not necessarily seeking to be sought after by, say, marketers or survey researchers like myself. And the way we do this is we take data that's available from the Census Bureau. The Census Bureau does a number of surveys, one of which is the American Community Survey, which is a survey of over 3 million households in the United States. Well, that includes households that have undocumented people in them. And so what we do is we identify the immigrant population of the United States. We then identify those who are in the country legally. And taking that difference, the residual, is what we use to generate an estimate of people who are likely in the country without authorization. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know for sure if they are, but this is an estimate of that population, given what we know about people who are in the country legally, who have citizenship.
Yeah, yeah. So give us the big picture findings here. There are 11 million or so undocumented immigrants in the country. How does that compare to years past?
So that's right, 11 million living in the country as of 2022. And I want to say 2022 is important to keep in mind given everything that's happened since 2022.
Mm-hmm.
But the number of undocumented or unauthorized people living in the country had reached a low of about 10.2 million right before the pandemic. So in 2019, we'd estimated that the population was about 10.2 million. The 11 million in the country today is actually a number that has been rising in recent years, but is still below the peak of 2007 when we estimate there were 12.2 million unauthorized immigrants living in the country then. So we've had a higher number of people living in the country who are undocumented, but we've also seen recently a reversal in a declining trend of the number of unauthorized immigrants living in the country, now on the increase.
That's interesting. And as you mentioned, that data goes back to 2022. We don't have data newer than that. But do you expect that same trend has probably continued over the last couple of years, in which, as you said, you know, a lot has changed on this front?
More than likely, the number of people who since 2022 have presented themselves at the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum protection, for example, are people who would be entering the country without authorization and will be a part of this unauthorized immigrant population number. So it's likely this number has continued to rise, maybe by at least 1.5, maybe 2 million people. But it remains to be seen because this is also a population that's oftentimes changing because people choose to return to their home countries, or also people may be deported, or people may pass away.
Do we know how many are in Arizona as compared to the rest of the country as a border state?
Yes, Arizona is an important state in this state. It's important to talk about Arizona's story when it comes to the size of its unauthorized immigrant population. So about 250,000 undocumented immigrants, we estimate, live in Arizona. That's about 3.5% of all Arizonans.
So let's talk about what might be behind this trend of increase. You talked about asylum seekers coming. We've heard, you know, story after story for so long until really just the last couple of months of border towns being packed, of Border Patrol being met with record numbers of people presenting themselves for asylum. Those people count as unauthorized immigrants?
Yes, because they enter the country without authorization. They're subject to deportation, and they're awaiting the decision on a legal case, that is the case of their asylum. So because they're in the country without authorization, they are identified as undocumented or unauthorized immigrants.
Where are these migrants coming from? You also found big changes here in terms of this assumption that migrants who are arriving at the border are coming from Mexico.
Yeah, this is actually one of the big stories of trends over the last, I'd say, 20 years. The number of undocumented immigrants from Mexico peaked in 2007 at almost 7 million people. So almost 7 million unauthorized immigrants from Mexico alone. They made up more than half of the undocumented immigrant population at the time. But today, as of 2022, I should say, there are 4 million undocumented immigrants from Mexico. So that's a drop of almost 3 million people since 2007. What we have seen, though, is a growing number of people from countries like El Salvador, from Guatemala, from Honduras, but also, interestingly, people from places like India, places like China, Brazil, places in Africa. And so that the composition of today's undocumented immigrants is different. It's changing compared to where we used to be. So while 4 million undocumented immigrants of that 11 million we were talking about earlier are from Mexico, the remainder are from other countries, with some countries like India among the fastest growing.
Wow. So not the profile we assume, right, arriving at the southern border.
Yeah, actually, that's an important point. It's not the same profile of people arriving at the southern border. It also includes people who may have overstayed a visa, or say were here for a job on an H-1B visa, lost their job but haven't left the United States, and so they fall into an unauthorized immigrant status because they don't have a visa to stay in the country. So all of that is part of the reason why we're seeing some change in the composition of origin countries, because people come to the U.S. for many different reasons.
Right, right. How big of a chunk of the population are visa overstayers? It used to be the majority. Is that still true?
Some of the research that the Congress has released, and certainly it's something that's hard to tell, so we can't really tell sort of where we are today, but it does seem like those who are overstays are a bigger part of the story than before. But the number of people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum protection, or also people who may be in the United States and have been granted temporary protected status, those numbers are up as well.
Right.
So there's a number of reasons, a number of sources for these changes. It's not just about overstays.
Yeah, yeah. There's also an interesting and sort of corresponding finding here that unauthorized workers have gone up by almost a million since 2019. Is this just, you know, corresponding with the rise in unauthorized immigrants? Like, these people will work. They just, you know, they'll work, quote unquote, under the table.
It's a little bit of that, and it's also that the U.S. over this period, at least since the end of the pandemic, has really seen strong job market growth, and many employers still are looking to fill jobs that haven't been filled. So part of this is the attractiveness of the U.S. job market and people coming to the U.S. to work in the job market.
Yeah. So at the same time, I want to put this into broader perspective, because this is still just a small chunk of the overall immigrant population, the legal immigrant population in the country, right?
That's right. I think this is actually one of the key takeaways from our report, is that when we talk about the more than 46 million people who are in the United States today who are immigrants, people born outside of the United States. Half of that group are U.S. citizens. They've naturalized. They've become U.S. citizens. And another quarter are people who are in the country legally. They're lawful permanent residents. They have the equivalent of what we would call a green card to be in the country and may even be on their way to becoming a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. So most immigrants in the United States today are in the country lawfully. More than three quarters, in fact, about 77%. That number has been going up because the number of immigrants who enter the country legally over the last 10 years or so has been growing faster than the declining number of unauthorized immigrants until just recently. But still, the unauthorized immigrant population only makes up about a quarter of all immigrants in the United States today.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Mark Hugo Lopez, Director of Race and Ethnicity Research at Pew Research Center, joining us. Mark, thanks for coming on. Thanks for breaking all these numbers down. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Last week, the Arizona Republic published a startling report on vaccination rates for measles around the state. According to their findings, only about one-third of schools in Arizona have what's known as herd immunity, defined as at least 95% of the student population being vaccinated against the disease. It wasn't always like this. The Republic reports that the vaccination rate for Arizona students has dropped by about half over the last decade, and reporter Caitlin McGlade, who wrote the piece, says there are two big reasons for the decline. For one thing, Arizona allows parents to opt out of vaccinating their kids based on personal beliefs. While religious exemptions are somewhat common in other states, our state is one of only 16 that broadens that standard to include non-religious exemptions. But, as McClade told me recently, that's not the only explanation.
Another thing that is specific to Arizona is that the state health department managed its free vaccine program in a way that drove out healthcare providers. So it's harder for uninsured families and those who depend on Medicaid to get their kids vaccinated.
So this, if I'm not mistaken, is the Vaccines for Children program.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a federal program, but it's obviously managed in our state by the health department. Why has it not been working as well as intended?
So several years ago, state health officials began forcing pediatricians to pay to replace vaccines they received for the program if they didn't use them before they expired. And that was very costly for the providers participating in the program. Providers also complained to researchers that the state's attempts at accountability weren't always accurate. So there's this one instance that the state health department announced it would charge 500 providers a total of $6 million for 86,000 doses that they said were unaccounted for. But actually, like 40% of the providers were able to prove they didn't owe anything. So there was just this constant mistrust going on for many years. Some providers told researchers that they were bullied. They were treated like they were guilty anytime the state came in. And it just became very difficult for them to participate. So the number of provider locations offering these free vaccines has basically shrunk in half over the past decade.
Wow. And was this fraught relationship between the providers and the health department, was that the case over the entire history of the Vaccines for Children program, or did something change in this recent 10-year period?
There was like a government accountability report from the feds that came out that encouraged states to cut down on vaccine waste. And it's my understanding from my sources that Arizona reacted to that report by basically cracking down. The Ducey administration kind of came down and said, well, we're going to really, really hold these doctors accountable and count every last vaccine. And the doctors were not happy about being that regulated.
Yes, which in turn has led to the decline in providers participating in the program, as you just mentioned. Is there a correlation between that and the fact that the drop-offs in vaccination rates are particularly steep in high poverty areas?
Yeah, so that was one of the things that really surprised me when I started crunching the numbers for the most recent school year. Glendale Landmark School in the southern part of that city experienced a really steep decline. The school went from having 100% of the kids vaccinated in 2015 to just 46% of kindergartners vaccinated last year.
Mm-hmm. And The thought, it seems, from what I gather in the piece, is that there just are fewer vaccination sites available to the parents in these poorer areas to get their kids vaccinated, right?
Right. That's what my sources say. That's what the researchers found when the county had a study done on declining vaccination rates. I would have loved to have done a further analysis and identified the areas that have like a desert of vaccination providers. But the state health department didn't give me a list when I asked for it. It also does not appear to be readily available online. So I'm not sure how parents are supposed to even find where to get free vaccines for their kids if they're uninsured or are on Medicaid.
Yeah. And I suppose that the rationale that the administrators of the Vaccines for Children program in Arizona would give in terms of cracking down on this alleged waste in the program is saving money. But as you report, it's actually much more expensive to treat a measles outbreak than to pay for vaccines, right?
Right. Bob England, who was the director of Maricopa County Health Department and also was there at the time when the state really started cracking down, he pointed to a number of different studies showing how expensive measles outbreaks are. One of them he pointed to was in Clark County, Washington. 72 people got the measles between December 2018 and April 2019. And the overall societal cost was about $3.4 million. And that's like $47,000 per sick person.
Right. And that's for just 72 cases.
Correct.
There also seems to be, from your reporting, some skepticism about vaccines in general that is intensifying this situation. Tell us about what you found there.
Correct. So there is a nationwide decline in vaccination rates for the measles, for a lot of vaccines. And there are a lot of researchers studying this and like why this could be. And we're definitely seeing that. Some of our local health department folks or our state health department folks have told me that, yes, they are seeing, you know, basically since the pandemic, an increased mistrust in all vaccines. There's a lot of stuff out there on Facebook, these posts that look like news articles. They sort of masquerade as news articles, mm-hmm. and they say a bunch of stuff that isn't true, but people spread them widely or like them. And they're more likely to get a lot of likes if they mimicked the styles of news or scientific reports. So this vaccine hesitancy from COVID-19, from people not wanting to get the COVID-19 vaccine because they were afraid of it, that sort of spilled over into other routine vaccines.
Gotcha. And is there any sense that the health department is doing anything to push back against the misinformation about the vaccines?
I asked about this, and the person who was the assistant director of public health preparedness told me they arm the schools with as much information as they can. They do try to dispel myths. But he did also say that they do have to be sensitive to the fact that in Arizona, law protects parents' right to choose whether or not to get their kids vaccinated. So I think some public health officials have to tread fairly lightly on that because of the law.
Gotcha. And just so folks know, in case they're in that cohort of people who tend to think of measles as something from a more bygone era, what can happen when someone gets measles? What does it do to you?
It used to like kill a lot of kids. The vaccine was first invented in 1963. Almost all children caught the measles before they turned 15 back then, like before the vaccine. And up to 4 million people in the U.S. would get it every year, and 400 or 500 of them died. 48,000 were hospitalized. 1,000 suffered brain swelling, things of that nature.
Wow. Well, Caitlin McGlade is an investigative reporter at the Arizona Republic. Caitlin, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Tingman. What do you think happens to your trash after you throw it away? What about your recyclables? If you're anything like me, you probably don't really think about it. Maybe that's because you find trash gross. Maybe it's because you want to believe that you're doing your part by throwing things away. Surely, you tell yourself, there must be a robust system in place that takes care of these things in a responsible way once you toss them. Well, it turns out there are literally mountains of questions about what happens to our trash. And journalist Oliver Franklin Wallace set out to answer those questions. In his book, Wasteland, Franklin Wallace travels to the rancid landfills and cavernous garbage incinerators of the global south. Along the way, he exposes the rampant fraud that plagues the multi-billion-dollar garbage market and proposes a radical reframing for how we think about waste, which, for many of us, starts with actually thinking about it in the first place.
The book opens on Ghazipur, which is one of the largest landfills in India. It's outside New Delhi. And the locals sometimes call it Mount Everest. It covers, I think, about 20,000 football fields. And there's an entire town, essentially, on this landfill, around the base of this landfill, filled with people who make a living collecting the waste and sorting it and taking out the things of value. So that's scrap metal, wire, plastics. So it's kind of both a place and kind of a miniature economy. And those landfills are all over the global south, you know, Malaysia, a lot of African countries. As you can imagine, they're not pretty. They smell. They're incredibly dangerous. They shift underneath your feet. Yeah. People fall and die quite often. They often catch fire.
Yeah, yeah. So related to all this, I've also heard you say, quote, the story of waste is the story of the growth of China. Tell us what that sentence means.
Yeah, that's right. So for a long time, for the kind of last decade of the 20th century and for the first couple of decades of this one, a lot of our waste was being shipped overseas and predominantly to China. So there's an estimate that about 50% of all plastic waste produced at one time was being exported to China. And China was using that to reprocess it and drive its huge manufacturing industry. Now, in about 2018, the Chinese government got a little bit sick of this situation and they shut their doors. They said, right, we're not taking any of this. We're sick of being the world's garbage can. We don't want it. And the result is that basically the entire waste industry worldwide went into meltdown. A bunch of big businesses went bankrupt. And we're kind of still seeing the fallout from that today. And that's really what started me on this journey, kind of understanding, well, hang on a minute, how did this happen? How did we become so reliant on exporting our waste to the other side of the world, where, by the way, it turns out, you know, a lot of it wasn't being recycled. A lot of it was being burned and being sorted through by children or some poor people in dreadful conditions. So really exposing that is why I set out on this journey and a large part of the reason why I wrote this book.
Yeah. So is it fair to say, not to fixate on the situation in China too much, but while we were able in the West to sell our waste to China while they were willing to buy it, and that was a fairly robust exchange, it was sort of masking some of these more entrenched problems, and that once that trade with China went away, the full scope of the problem became clear. Is that an accurate characterization?
For sure. I think the biggest thing that kind of came to light after China shut its doors to the world's plastic and recycling in 2018 is the realization of how little recycling is actually being recycled. We talk about recycling, we talk about national recycling rates, for example, and I'm, as you can probably tell from the accent here in the UK, our national recycling rate's about 43%. Recycling rates are essentially a lie. They're a con. You count the things as recycled as soon as they kind of enter the door of the recycling factory. But in this specific case, only half of what was being reported as being recycled was actually being recycled, right? So that the actual recycling rate was half.
So half of that is 43%.
Exactly. So the honest, and you know, when you're thinking about loading things on container ships and sending them to China, we have no idea how much of that is being recycled. So the whole thing has kind of been built on these obfuscations and misdirections going back decades. And what's happened now is that we're really starting to grapple with this issue that we've kind of swept under the carpet or dumped in a landfill. And really trying to understand, you know, well, how big is this problem? The answer is it's pretty huge.
Well, speaking of dishonest conversations, this brings us to the real bombshell in the book, and not to give it away, but it is such a bombshell, which is that 97%, you report, of global waste is actually industrial waste and not individual waste.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you said that, because it is, you know, it is the big, I joke about it as being like the murder mystery twist in the book.
It feels that way when you're reading it.
Is that, yeah, the vast majority of our waste is not the stuff that you and I throw away at home. It's the stuff that is made in the production of our goods. You know, you think about the iPhone that you hold in your hand. You don't think about the tons and tons and tons of mining waste that's been dug out of a Bolivian mountainside or a Congolese, you know, jungle in order to get at the metals. You don't think about all of the trees that have been felled to make the cardboard box, right? So we have this system that's designed to make us forget that, because if you understand the true cost of the things we're buying, you know, it would blow your mind. You'd be horrified. So it's really important for me for people to understand that when we talk about waste, the majority of it has already happened. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be having a discussion about what we throw away. We throw away about 2 billion tons of consumer waste every year. That's just a lot of stuff.
Yeah. But the question to me in that murder mystery twist is, and that seems so maddening in the context of everything that we're talking about, is if I've understood correctly, the infrastructure to successfully recycle a lot of this waste that is being created, not all of it, but a lot of it, does exist. It's just that there is not systemic investment in ensuring that that recycling is taking place. It's like a problem with a solution. The solution just has a price tag, right?
You're exactly right. I'm so glad that you said that, because, you know, I'm going to get a little bit nerdy here and use an economics term. An economist would call it waste an externality. That means the cost is borne by someone else, right? If you make a bottle and you sell it to someone, it's like the cost of disposing with it is with that guy who's just bought your product, right? And, you know, companies don't want to pay more than they have to. So it ends up being a socialized cost. It ends up falling on the taxpayer. And the thing that people always ask me, you know, at the end of every book event that I do, or the end of every interview, they say, well, you know, what can I do? And I said, well, buy less. And they kind of look at me downcast, because it doesn't sound like much fun, right? And my mission is to kind of convince people that that's actually a more satisfying way of living. Because I say, you know, buy less, but buy better. You know, buy less sounds like no fun at all, right? It sounds ascetic. It sounds like you're like a monk living in a monastery somewhere. Buy better, you're like, oh, hang on a minute. That's something we should all aspire to, right? And fundamentally, for me, that's not just about having things that are better made. What you end up with is you end up with like a more healthy, more satisfying relationship with things. I often think of my old neighbor, Alan. There's a guy who used to, he's big into classic cars, and he had a really nice Jaguar who used to be out on his driveway every Sunday morning, you know, waxing and polishing his car, took beautiful care of it. And I always think, if we took care of our things in the way that Alan took care of his car, we would all just be happier. You know, the planet would be cleaner, the oceans wouldn't have so much plastic in it, but also we'd just be living better lives as people.
Well, a note of optimism from Oliver Franklin Wallace to close out the conversation. Oliver Franklin Wallace is the author of Wasteland, The Secret World of Waste and the Urgent Search for a Cleaner Future. Oliver, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The most popular baby names in Arizona last year were Liam and Olivia, followed by a few other blockbusters, Mateo, Emma, Mia, Noah, and of course, Oliver. And our next guest's job is to avoid them. Colleen Slagan is a professional baby name consultant. That's right, that's a thing. Her business is called Naming Bebe, and it's taken off so much in recent months, the former nurse practitioner quit her day job to help parents-to-be come up with the perfect names for their little bundle of joy. I spoke with her more about the art of finding the perfect baby name, not too popular, not too weird, and making a business out of it. And she told me it all began with a family friend who put together a sort of market analysis of the baby naming industry for her that helped her take it from hobby to career.
He said, you know, if you really want to make a business out of this, you're going to have to basically show your face on social media, which I did not have any interest in doing. fast forward, I mustered up the courage to start posting some of the consultations I had done. And I think it was like, you know, a little bit of right place, right time. I had some viral hits. And let's see, about 6 months later, I quit my job to fully invest my time in this business.
Oh, man. So that went fast. A little bit of it viral did. Internet stuff will go far and fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, talk a little bit about why baby names. Like, how did this become a thing that you were interested in? It seems like a made-up thing or like it's out of left field. But in fact, this has been around for a long time, you say.
It really has. I remember being interested in baby names from a super young age. My sister and I, you know, we had diaries, as many children did. And I mostly filled them with baby names, not feelings. We would just play games. You know, if you had seven kids and they all had to start with letter A, what would you use? Mm-hmm. And we would fill entire notebooks with these games. I owned several baby name books. I was actually at my parents' house this past weekend with my kids and my husband, and I was looking through one of my old baby name books. I think it was from 2002, and I had a piece of paper in there with all my favorite names. But I think part of it is a little bit idyllic. Like, I guess some girls dream about their wedding and others dream about what names are going to be on their holiday card once they have kids.
I can see it's like MASH on steroids. I get it. It makes sense.
Oh, yes. I was a big MASH girl.
Okay. So tell us, like, where do you come up with names? How do you search things? Do you look at books, or are we way beyond that now?
No, I do look at books. I still love baby name books. Mm-hmm. I definitely use the internet. You know, my friends are little minions out in the wild who report back to me when they're at like a children's birthday party. And my ears are always alert. You know, at the park, when I take my kids to swim class, when I check them in, I am taking a long time so I can scan the entire list of names to see, you know, what's out there. Uh-huh. I look at restaurant names and street signs. I'm just like always kind of looking for inspiration.
So why, I always wonder this, like, why do you think certain names take off? Like, why do you think there really are clear winners and losers in baby names every year?
Yeah, I think that remains one of life's great mysteries. Some of it is that familiarity breeds likeness. But what initially starts it, it's hard to say. But for example, the name Olivia, for people who aren't intentionally engaging in, you know, social media accounts with baby names or reading books or aren't baby name obsessed, mm-hmm. they're getting ideas from being out in public or seeing what names are being used on their social media feed by friends and family. And so you hear a name and you like it, and it oftentimes you'll get a positive association from names you're hearing. Hmm. And I think that's the case with a lot of like cultural trends too. You know, a lot of fashion trends you may poo-poo at first, and the more you see it, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, okay, I kind of like that.
It takes off, yeah. Okay, so tell us how this process works. Like, I know at this point you're like turning away requests, right? Like, this has become such a big thing. People are really seeking this out. What do you do with a family when they come to you and say, okay, we need a name?
So I send them I think it's now 15 question survey.
Wow. Okay.
You know, from basic questions like what are your siblings' names, what's your last name, to stylistic preferences like what are names you like, what are names you like but that one partner has vetoed, what are names you like but you can't use them because, you know, your cousin already used it, to sort of the nitty gritty, like, are there certain sounds that you want to avoid? If your last name starts with O, you might not want a first name that ends with O. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of give them a open question at the end to tell me a little bit about themselves. And I get to work. I first give them feedback on their top contenders. I think it's a really big piece of it, actually, is just getting a objective and professional opinion about their top names. And then I create a list of recommendations that I sort of break down by category, and I include information about popularity and sort of my rationale as to why I think it fits in their sibling set or would appeal to their style. And then, of course, naming is subjective at the end of the day. So very likely on the list they receive, there are going to be instant no's from one partner or the other. And so at the end, I include a list of what I call honorable mentions. So names I considered but didn't make top 10.
Okay. Do you recommend a lot of the same names all the time, or is this really pretty, you know, depending on what those folks want?
It definitely depends on what folks want. I've talked to other baby name consultants, and some of us will say like, oh, sometimes we feel like we're in an echo chamber, because through our content, you've got a sense of what our style is. And I think then people are drawn to you if they have a similar style. So I definitely get some consultations, especially on the boys' side, where people are less likely to get creative, I would say, with names. There's some repetition, but I've never created two lists that are the same.
So give us the two extremes here. Like, what are the most common requests you get from folks? Like, what types of names they're looking for? What are some of the oddest?
I would say the most common request I get is sort of, I call it like the Goldilocks name, where it's not overly common, but it's familiar to all. So I think, you know, a name that is having a moment right now is the name Margot.
Yeah.
And I think that really exemplifies that category. I think August for boys, it's a familiar name, but it's not very common. Mm-hmm. Graham, I think, is another example for the boys. As far as unique requests, I'm about to work with somebody who, she will not name her child something that she's ever heard before.
Wow. That could be hard.
So I'm looking forward to that one. And then I wish I remember the verbiage this person used, but her inspiration was Game of Thrones and like Adam's family. So names with sort of a dark feel to them.
So specific. Okay, yes. So then the last thing I will ask you, Colleen, is your favorite names right now. Like, what are your wishes? Like, you wish you could get everyone to jump on board these certain names.
I mean, I'm absolutely obsessed with the girl named Nellie.
So cute.
Now, I would use a formal name and nickname to Nellie because that's more my style, but I'm obsessed with it. I think Greer is such a cool name that is super uncommon. Kit is another one for girls that
adorable.
I love. I was recently talking to somebody about the name Lenore, and I think that's a style that's sort of emerging, these like kind of main character names. I think it's so pretty and so nicknameable. I could go on and on and on. I would say the other name where like if I were renaming a sibling set that I would probably use is Philippa with the nickname Pippa.
So cute. Yeah.
So cute.
Colleen, Ms. Slagan, thank you so much for joining us to talk this through. And good luck coming up with that name that she's never heard of. I appreciate that one.
Thank you so much. Great chatting with you.
Okay, so Sam, have you been watching the Olympics this week? Any favorite events?
Yes. I don't know what this says about me, but I'm partial to the ones that remind me of college. So I'm really into badminton and table tennis.
That's awesome. Okay, but here's one for you. Did you know that poetry used to be an Olympic sport?
Whoa. Speaking of college, I did not know that.
It's true. Between 1912 and 1952, the Olympics included an arts competition known as the Pentathlon of the Muses, and medals were awarded for music, literature, poetry, even architecture. But the submissions had to have some direct connection with sport.
Pentathlon of the Muses.
So good, right?
Sounds like a Jethro Tull album. let me ask you, Lauren, have you ever written a poem about your favorite sport? haiku about running, ode to the pommel horse, fencing limerick?
Man, I wish, but no, I have not. If I were in Paris, I might be moved to poetry, though. It's so beautiful there. I'll give it some thought the next time I'm at my kid's soccer game.
Sounds good.
Look. little bit of Olympic fanfare for your Tuesday edition of the show. That'll do it. Be sure to join us again tomorrow morning with much more, including, of course, whatever primary election results we have. For Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of the show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.